Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and thank you for joining us for a very special episode of Living History. This week marked an important anniversary for all of you who know your First World War history. You'll be aware of what I'm talking about. It's the German Spring Offensive in 1918, the big German gamble to try and win the First World War in one fell swoop. And it occurred in 1918. It was a monumental moment in the history of the First World War. It really changed the complexion of the First World War and in many ways was the beginning of the end of the First World War. Very important for Australian troops. They achieved great fame by assisting the British to stop the German Spring Offensive in places like Hasbrook and most famously at Villers-Bretonneux. So it's a really fascinating story, part of history that's probably a little bit overlooked. And so I wanted to bring you this special episode, an interview I did several years ago with a wonderful historian called Paul Reed. If you haven't seen his Old Frontline podcast, go and check that out. Paul has a fantastic podcast where he walks the ground of the First World War battlefields. But it was a great pleasure to catch up with Paul and to talk all about the German Spring Offensive. So I do hope you enjoy this special episode.
A date which will live in infamy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
There's a second plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. I think we have a terrorist attack.
This was our finest hour.
Paul, it's really great to have you on the show. And this week marks a very important centenary, 100 years since the German Spring Offensive, the monumental attack that took place at the start of 1918. So why don't we begin with your brief history of what was going on at this time? What were the Germans trying to achieve? What was happening in March 1918?
Well, hi, Matt. Well, thanks for having me on. 100 years ago, it was the Kaiserschlacht or the Kaiser's Battle or Operation Michael. It goes by many names. The situation on the Western Front was at this stage quite critical, really, because the Germans had now ended the war on the Eastern Front, which doesn't really concern us. But from their point of view, it had released more than 1 million combat troops to come and fight in the West. And this was imperative because the Allied position was strengthening with the arrival of the American Expeditionary Force that had joined the war the previous April, in April 1917. And they had this vast army. But just like the British Army at the beginning of the First World War, it was untrained and it was going to take a certain amount of time to get it up to speed and get it combat ready. And by early 1918, the Germans were pretty convinced that it was now only going to be months, if not weeks, before those Americans, the doughboys, did arrive. And, of course, that would tip the balance in the favour of the Allies, and they feared that the outcome of the war would be pretty much guaranteed. It would go in the Allies' favour. So using these troops from the Eastern Front, using a build-up of equipment, munitions, the time was right to launch an offensive, and that's exactly what happened on the morning of the 21st of March 1918.
So what actually happened on this day? I mean, let's talk about the German plans, because the Germans went about this in a little bit of a different way, didn't they, to attacks that we'd seen earlier in the war?
They did, because if you look at the German experience on the Western Front, for pretty much most of the war, it's a defensive war for them. That they've not been really fighting majorly offensive battles, certainly against the British, for quite some time. So they've seen what the British have done. They've seen the achievements that the British Army's had in various places. And everybody, by this stage of the war, is beginning to come to terms with what the Western Front was about and beginning to develop ideas of what we now call modern war. And the Germans base a lot of this plan in March 1918 on their experience on the Eastern Front in battles like Riga. with using a huge amount of artillery. And this really artillery for both sides becomes the key to victory in the First World War. Guns of all caliber are really both the king and queen of the battlefield. And using this mass of artillery, plus infiltration tactics, using stormtroopers, Stormtruppen, to infiltrate their way through parts of the battlefield to not let the first wave be too occupied in sweeping up vast territories of ground, but taking out strong points and so on. And then the follow-up waves will mop up, as we'd call it, and then you'd achieve a breakthrough. So a combination of a massive artillery destroying the enemy's positions, destroying their strong points, destroying their infrastructure, infiltration troops going in to take out key targets, and then a huge amount of men following up. So you've got a rapid movement with reserves close by.
This is the element I love about the First World War, is that it's you know, we as historians, we're constantly battling against this idea that the First World War was all generals in chateaus and old tactics and just marching towards machine guns. When you describe what the Germans were doing in early 1918 and think that less than 4 years earlier, it basically was, you know, almost Napoleonic, troops marching towards each other in these first clashes in 1914. It's a fantastic illustration of how technologically advanced the First World War was and how quickly things moved forward, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the German experience of the beginning of the war, you could argue that that's closer to the Prussians at Waterloo. And then if you look at the German experience in March 1918, that is much more closer to the role of the Wehrmacht in the invasion of Poland, France, and Holland at the beginning of the Second World War. So it's how the war has moved on. And you're absolutely right that the public perception is that lines of men day after day advanced, pushed forward by unthinking commanders, straight into withering enemy machine gun fire, and the war came to an end simply because one side had more men left than the other, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
So what was the result of this initial attack on the 21st of March and the attacks that followed up? How successful was this new German way of fighting, and how was their success against the Allies?
Well, it had devastating results in the early stage of the battle. They attacked in the early part of the morning, a huge amount of artillery, weapons of every caliber from trench mortars up to heavy guns, causing devastating bombardments onto the British positions. And in some cases, parts of the British line buckled in the first 30 minutes to an hour of the battle. The Germans had another factor in their favour that morning, and that was fog. It was very, very foggy, and the fog hid a lot of their infantry as they moved forward. So in some cases, British units really didn't know that the Germans were on top of them until literally they were there standing in front of their parapet, or in some cases even they're directly already in their trenches. So that little quirk of nature that day, that little meteorological facet, tipped the balance in the favour of the Germans. And I mention it because in one or two areas where the fog lifted, this is where you begin to see the German plan break down. The village of Effie, roughly in the middle of the Fifth Army front, the fog was less dense there. And when I've taken groups to that bit of the battlefield, I've got two accounts that I read to them. One is of a German machine gunner on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and the other is of a British machine gunner at that spot on the 21st of March 1918. And they read almost identically, in that the German machine gunner is mowing down the British on the beautiful sunlit morning of the 1st of July, and the British machine gunner is mowing down the Germans in the clear weather that existed on that part of the front. So that makes you wonder, would the Germans have been able to push forward quite as much as they did do if the weather had been different? Because they did have a lot of success that day. They overran the British positions. British lost over 38,500 casualties, of which 21,000 were men taken prisoner, one of the highest figures for a single day in the war. And the Germans had captured a big chunk of the front from north of Flesquières in the Third Army sector down to south of Saint-Quentin, and Quentin, the Fifth Army sector. And within a few weeks, they'd pushed 35 miles all the way to the village of Villers-Bretonneux.
That's extraordinary, that figure of the prisoners. I didn't realize that before. I knew the casualties were high. I've seen the memorials down there that talk about the losses, but I didn't realize that prisoner figure was so high. Just extraordinary. I mean, when you talk about all this, Paul, I think we often have this perception of the Germans that they were these absolute elite fighters on the battlefield. You know, in the First World War and the Second World War, we almost put them up on a pedestal that the Germans were streets ahead of everyone else, and it was just that they didn't have enough resources to push their advantage home. But when you tell that story, it reflects on something that I've seen quite a lot, that the Germans took advantage of luck quite often. They had good plans, they had very good training, they had very good leadership, but they also got very lucky a lot of the time, and perhaps in some instances they did better than they potentially deserved to, particularly probably more in the Second World War, but certainly in cases like this as well. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
It is. When you look at the German casualties for this, they lost nearly 40,000 on the 21st of March 1918. And this exposes one of the realities of the First World War, and in fact, modern warfare per se, in that you can gain ground on this scale, as the Germans did, but it costs you hugely in casualties. You're inflicting losses on the enemy, but you're suffering them as well. And this really, I think, cuts to the real chase of the issue in 1918, is that we had a manpower problem ourselves, in that a huge amount of our troops had been held back and the British Expeditionary Force was massively under strength. The Germans had released these men from Russia, but they were suffering manpower and would increasingly suffer manpower problems for the rest of the year. And they could ill afford to lose these men. So whereas we lost 21,000 prisoners in one day, and we lost thousands more as this battle went on, we had thousands in depots in Britain waiting to come over to replace them. We lost 500 guns within a few days. These things are being shipped over to replace them. And I think, again, it exposes the fact that the Allied war effort had moved on greatly and the German war effort had struggled, particularly as submarine blockades were beginning to take hold. And although the Germans had luck, as they did on this day, and they advanced greatly and they used new tactics and a huge amount of artillery, was this in the end a battle that they could ever win based on the fact that it would cost them so dearly?
Talk to me about a part of battle that we tend to ignore quite a bit. We talk a lot about battles and attacks and men fighting each other in the front line, but the part that we tend to overlook is logistics and operations and moving armies around. And I think that this German attack, that was a really telling factor, wasn't it, in the fact that they had great success on the first day, but the further they advanced, things started to slow down. Talk to us a bit about the logistics and the operational issues that were hampering the Germans in this attack.
Well, I mean, logistics, as you say, that it's not the sexiest part of military history, but in many respects, it's one of the most important, because an army cannot operate without ammunition for its weapons, food for its troops, petrol for its vehicles. And the Germans, because they've not had this experience of advancing on the Western Front in the same way the British have, they haven't invested in the infrastructure in the same way that we did. So that when they begin to push forward so quickly, their huge tail of men and equipment behind them struggles to catch up, and they struggle to reinforce it. And if you just even look at the German weapons and equipment of the period, the Germans are running out of material for their war effort, and they're running out even of food. When you read some of the accounts of March 1918, some of the German attacks break down in sectors, not because the British are actually fighting and stopping them, but because the Germans overrun British supply depots and are incredulous that they find thousands of tins of bully beef, meat, which these men have not seen for quite some time. There's whiskey there for officers, rum for the troops, and everything else. So the Germans stop fighting and begin eating. And this reflects the problems, you know, in this whole system of supply that the Germans did not effectively have in 1918. And I think if you look at any conflict, the victors are the ones that invest in infrastructure, and the British had been investing in that infrastructure for years and years, in many respects since the very beginning, because the plan to bring us across to France in 1914, the first troops over on the 5th of August 1914, were not the cavalry, were not the infantry, they were lines of communication troops, Army Service Corps, Royal Engineers, to come and establish the depot at Rouen then, to get the British Expeditionary Force up towards the front line. So from the very beginning, we see the importance of that, and that's what paves the way to victory in many respects.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's an extraordinary story that you mentioned there about the Germans stopping their advance so that the starving troops could gorge themselves on the supplies they've just captured. The facets of the war that we don't even really think about. You mentioned the British and the way they reacted to this. Obviously, there was a big breakthrough by the Germans on the first day, the 21st of March. But what happened after that? I mean, the battle went on into April. So what were the results of the middle and the later campaign?
Well, the Germans keep pushing forward, and the British begin to utilise the terrain between Saint-Quentin and Villers-Bretonneux, which is a mixture of rivers, canals, flat areas in the Santerre Plain, where there's lots of little villages and wooded areas, and they use that to make successive defensive, ad hoc defensive lines and slow the German offensive down. But the momentum keeps going, and the Germans keep pushing us back. Until a point by early April of 1918 that they've swept across the old Somme battlefields, villages like Pozières, and even the town of Albert, which had been the main hub of the British and Australian Canadian forces on the Somme in 1916. That has now fallen to the Germans. But they're now at the gates of Amiens. By getting to Villers-Bretonneux, which is on the dead straight Roman road from Saint-Quentin to Amiens, they are getting to a point where they're getting very close to the point of supply of the British Expeditionary Force on the northern part of the front, which is the place where the trains come in with troops, where the trains come in with equipment and ammunition and everything else. If they capture that, this could be a very, very different war. The outcome of it could be very different. And the Allies are all too aware of that, as are, of course, the Germans. So that becomes the hot spot, if you like, of the tail end of this battle.
Well, let's talk about the Australian involvement, because I think it's probably something that Australia historically has perhaps overplayed out the significance of our role in stopping the Germans during the spring offensive. And then there was a movement for a while to downplay our role and to say none of the Australians were a very minor part of the whole thing, and it was mostly the British that stopped the attack. In your opinion, at places like Hasbrook and the Yep Forest and obviously Villers-Bretonneux, which was the most important Australian operation at this time, what role did the Australians play in ending this German offensive?
Well, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt the Australians played a key role in this because for a number of reasons, is that Australian divisions were much stronger than British ones at this period because of the reorganisation of the British Army. We'd gone from 12 fighting battalions down to 9 in every division, which had reduced the number of fighting troops. That wasn't the same in an AIF division, so they were stronger. They had been out of action for a while, so they'd been built back up to strength, and they were in different parts of the front, and they were not in the front line on the 21st of March 1918 where the Germans attacked, so it meant that they were not affected by that early phase. So they were ready as a battle reserve to be brought down, and indeed that's exactly what happens. Some to plug the gap between Arras and the Somme, then units brought down to Villers-Bretonneux, and then as the battle moves on in the Battle of the Lys in April, as you mentioned, Hazebrouck is another, and the Nieppe Forest are two key areas where Australian troops fight alongside British units, notably the Guards, for example, and leave an everlasting impression on the British Army for their professionalism and bravery in that battle. I mean, you know, I've spent many, many years following the Australians around the Western Front and taking Australian groups and individuals around those battles. I have nothing but respect for the Australian soldier. Often, you guys see him as a larrikin, somebody who's a bit off the wall, and has got one eye on his unbuttoning his top tunic button to cock a sort of snoot at the British. But the reality is, Australian units were highly trained, highly disciplined, and highly effective. And to have that amount of highly trained troops ready to be committed to the front line at this point was critical in this, in all aspects of this battle. And the same with Canadians as well. We can't forget their role in this.
I think that's very well said, Paul. And this whole idea that, you know, when Australians get a little bit cocky and say that the British were all bunglers and we showed them how to do it, I don't see a lot of that during the war years. There were some official reports along those lines. Charles Bean, for example, the founder of the War Memorial in Australia, was always a little bit critical of the British, particularly in the earlier stages of the Western Front. But generally, the things that I've read, there was a huge respect between the Australians and the British, and the Australians recognised that they couldn't have been doing any of this without the obvious huge support of the British, and that they were an important part of the British Army. And No other time was that more obvious, I think, than at this time when British and Australian forces were fighting side by side to hold back the Germans. There's a lot of accounts that I've read of huge respect for both sides in the cooperative job they were doing to stop the Germans.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, I mean, at the time, you know, they were all part of the British Expeditionary Force. And we see them as, in terms of their national identity 100 years later, I think there was less of that. It was much more blurred, particularly, you know, even by 1918, Australian units still had a lot of people who were only first generation, who'd come from Britain before the war, as with many Commonwealth nations at that time. So that identity was there, not as strong as it is today. And many of them probably would have still called themselves British, possibly even before they'd have said they were Australian. But there was this identity with Australian troops, you know, going back to the things that they'd done earlier in the war. Gallipoli is a good example of that, of course, but elsewhere, I mean, you know, Gallipoli is the Australian obsession, but the real defining moment of Australia in the Great War, in my opinion, is the Western Front.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I think Gallipoli deserves its place in our memory, and will always be important to us. But I'm delighted to see that more and more Australians are discovering what we did on the Western Front, and particularly in 1918, which I think was really our most important year. Coming back to what Germany was doing in this big attack, here's the big question. How close did Germany come to winning the war at this time?
Well, I think they came close. But for some of the reasons we've already said, in terms of trying to keep the momentum of an offensive going and then the huge losses that you're sustaining, tens of thousands of casualties a day, they simply wasn't possible. And unless they had moved much more quickly down that long Roman road and got to Amiens, the failure to take it, having being stopped by Australian and British troops at Villers-Bretonneux in April 1918, meant that the outcome of that aspect of the offensive was going to come to a halt, and that's exactly what happened. So the offensive then moves to the north with the operations on what we call the Battle of the Lys in April 1918, and another offensive on the Chemin des Dames near Reims in May, another one in the Marne and close to Paris. And so if you look at the German army in that period, they're attacking everywhere along the Western Front. They're breaking through. They're pushing the Allies back, inflicting losses on us, but losing huge amounts of men themselves. So having come close to victory, it's drifting away from them because that manpower resource is going and the whole aspect of the German army changes. And as the war goes on, the whole aspect of supply gets worse and worse. I mean, back in the 1980s, when I interviewed Great War veterans, many fought in that period of the war from the spring through to the victory in November 1918. They knew the usual German words of ja, nein, and kamerad, yes, no, and comrade. But very often, one German word that they would know would be Fleisch, which is the German word for meat, because they would capture a German prisoner at that time, and he'd pop his hands up and say, kamerad, Fleisch bitte. And they're after tins of bully beef. And of course, you know, whether they're Australian, Canadian, or British troops, they've been chomping on this stuff since the first day they enlisted. They're sick of it. You can have it, mate. You're welcome to it. But it just gives you an idea of just how desperate the German army was. So having militarily got close to victory, logistically, and in terms of manpower, the whole thing falls apart. And what with submarine blockades, what with the eventual arrival of American troops in the combat zone, the outcome of the war in the Allies' favour was pretty much certain.
It sounds from that description, Paul, that in spite of the good ideas the Germans had come up with for the spring offensive, they never actually had the potential to win the war. But fast forward 20 years. I mean, you touched on this before. This idea of assault troops moving quickly through an area and bypassing strong points to leave for later troops and new types of weaponry and use of artillery and lightly armoured assault troops, this sounds very much like what we saw at the start of the Second World War. Was the German spring offensive the genesis of Blitzkrieg in the Second World War?
Well, that's a very good question. It's something that historians have asked quite a few times, really. I think there are aspects of it, but then when you read the men who led German forces in the Blitzkrieg, like Hans Guderian, for example, in his memoirs, he really pins that moment on the British, Australian and Canadian offensive on the 8th of August 1918, the breakout on the Somme. To him, that was the really first proper demonstration of Blitzkrieg, in that it saw artillery, tanks, infantry and aircraft all working in cooperation in what you could describe really as the moment, the first 20th century modern battle. So March 18, and in some respect from a British point of view, Cambrai in November 1917, and then some of the things that happened before that, these are all steps towards Blitzkrieg. But I think what you could describe as true Blitzkrieg, if there is such a thing, doesn't really begin until the British launch the offensive on the Somme in August. And of course, that is paved in itself by the actions of Australian troops at La Hamel and the general experience of British and Commonwealth forces on the Western Front in the preceding years.
That's a fascinating suggestion that some of the concepts that led to obviously that very successful Blitzkrieg in the Second World War were actually started by the British, not the Germans themselves. I suppose tanks were an important part of that, weren't they? In Blitzkrieg in the Second World War, tanks played a huge role. There were some tanks being used. Obviously, the British had a lot more tanks than the Germans in the First World War, but the speed and the armament, etc., was not even comparable to what we saw in 1939, 1940, was it?
No. I mean, in many respects, you could argue that we perfected Blitzkrieg and then spent the next 20-odd years forgetting it. And it was the Germans who picked up on it, and they were the ones that developed it and fine-tuned it to exactly what we saw at the beginning of World War II. But then you look at the Kaiser's battle, and it should have given them warnings in terms of what they did operationally in 1939, 40, and certainly in Russia in 1941. Because the same problems of an offensive breaking down because the logistics tail are too big. On the Somme in March 1918, that is nothing compared to the German experience in Russia in 1941, when we're talking about vast, vast areas. So all of these are little marker posts throughout military history, and they give us an insight into what happened later.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for this. It's been absolutely fascinating, and it's an important time, especially as Australians. We don't look at this enough. We focus on the Battle of Villers-Bretonneux, and we think that was kind of the start of the involvement in 1918. But obviously, there was a lot more going on before then, and we should this week remember 100 years ago. You know, a lot of British soldiers died, a lot of Germans died in this absolutely horrendous conflict, and you know, on a scale that we had never seen to that point. So it's been really wonderful to talk to you about it. Thank you so much for giving us your expertise, and we'd love to have you back on again to talk about more elements of both the First and the Second World War.
My absolute pleasure, Matt.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.